Copyright notice. The contents of this podcast, including intro music, are copyright Phantom Femme. The podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org. This labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times, and ours. Hello, everyone, and welcome, finally, to episode 16 of In This Labyrinth. I am, as always, your host, Phantom Femme, and, sorry this episode is, once again, a little late. We had some technical difficulties there, and, in fact, a rather scary moment when I thought I wasn't going to be able to record, but thankfully that sorted itself out, and then I really had to get my students' book reports marked so that I could return them in time for my comments to be actually of some use before their next assignment was due. So, yeah, it's been busy. And that kind of held up the works a bit. And apologies also for the lengthy hiatus between episodes 14 and 15. As those of you who follow my social media will know, there was a period there when my hosting got suspended because I wasn't able to pay for it because my credit card got maxed out by the move, by my moving this summer. So there was a period there where episode 15 was only available on my Patreon. But thankfully, I've been able to get my credit card paid down and my hosting out of hock and unsuspended. So we're back up and going now, thank goodness. And thank everyone very much for their patience with all that. It's very much appreciated. And thank you all for hanging in and for continuing to listen. I've been impressed and delighted to see my download stats continue to go up even while things were kind of in suspended animation there for a bit. So that's awesome. Thank everyone so much for that. And of course, I know it's slightly belated, but happy Halloween or happy Samhain, depending on how you celebrate that, to everyone out there. I hope you all had a really great but safe time and got lots of nice, lovely, yummy stuff to eat. And of course, for all you PHAN fans out there, I hope you all were able to go as your favorite Phantom character. As I think I've mentioned before here, I go as a slightly femme version of the Phantom and have for, oh my goodness, almost every year for the past 30, well, it'll be 30 years next year now. Wow. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do that this year because I ended up spending Halloween night at home marking my students' book reports. But I hope you all had fun out there going out as your favorite Phantom characters. IMO, it's a pity we don't get to do that more often. It's a pity we only get to let our Phantom alter egos out of the box once a year at Halloween. Or maybe a couple of times a year, if you're lucky enough to be connected to a good cosplay scene where you can do that. Anyway, I've got what I hope will be a really interesting and enjoyable, somewhat Halloween-related episode for you all today. But just before I get to that, I want to take a moment to give a shout-out to Alice, who just pledged on my Patreon. Thank you so much, Alice. That is awesome and very much appreciated. And for your support, you now get access to podcast bonus content whenever I get around to doing it, access to some of my writing, and a poster version of the podcast artwork. So I do hope you will enjoy all of that. Okay, so because it was just Halloween, I want to talk about haunting. Because, of course, Phantom is about a haunting, although not what you might call or think of as a sort of classic haunting. Because, of course, the Phantom is not actually a ghost or a revenant. He's not a deceased person who's come back in supernatural form. He's a person, he's a human being, who's taken on the role or the persona of a ghost, of a supernatural being, and who uses his extraordinary abilities to perform that role, to enact that persona. And so I think haunting in Phantom can be kind of understood on two levels. On one hand, the Phantom's taking on this role, this persona of the opera ghost can be seen as kind of a literary device that allows Gaston Leroux and later versions to borrow a whole lot of tropes and conventions from the gothic slash horror genre and create this wonderfully spooky atmosphere in the story full of mystery and uncanniness. But also, I think haunting in Phantom can be read on another level as kind of an extended metaphor, though I don't think, or at least I very much doubt, consciously or intentionally. And that's what I want to talk about and explore in this episode. Because, as I said, I'm pretty sure I'd be willing to guess that this use of haunting as an extended metaphor was not done consciously or intentionally by Gaston Leroux or the creative team of the ALW, the Lloyd Webber version. But in spite of that, or maybe because of that, it's really brilliant and powerful, and I think is a huge part of what gives the story of Phantom the power that it has. So there's been some brilliant academic work on haunting done in the past few years that I've heard about from some of my colleagues and been meaning to look into for ages, and finally did for this episode. In particular, an absolutely fantastic book called Ghostly Matters, Haunting and the Sociological Imagination by Avery F. Gordon. And I'll put the full reference, bibliographic reference information for that in the blog post for this episode, because it talks about haunting as a way of thinking about, a way of conceptualizing, even a way of relating to the lingering effects of trauma and violence, either personal or social, and as a way of understanding, thinking about, relating to the link between trauma and violence at the personal level and at the social level. Or rather, not so much the link, but the interconnection, the interconnectedness between those two levels. Gordon talks about how violent or traumatic events like war, like slavery, etc., have effects and memories that linger on like ghosts, and sometimes even as the phenomena that people perceive as ghosts or hauntings, long after the events themselves are past and may even have been forgotten, either innocently forgotten or deliberately sort of erased, written out of the historical record. And Gordon talks about how these ghosts, these memories, need to be specifically and directly addressed before we can move on to a better place, before we can actually build a better and more just society. Now, I should say that that's very much a simplified summary of Gordon's argument. It's much more complex and sophisticated than that. And I'm going to be thinking about it and about how it relates to Phantom for a long time to come. But that is the basic gist of it, although, again, I would highly recommend that if you're interested, you go read the book itself, because a short summary like that doesn't come anywhere close to doing it justice. But it's interesting and fascinating because that way of thinking about and understanding haunting is, I think, very much the way that haunting is used as an extended metaphor in Phantom. At least in what fans might think of as the canon versions or the serious versions. So the original Gaston Leroux novel, of course, the Lloyd Webber musical, the Susan Kay novel, and I would argue the 1990 miniseries with Charles Dance as well, although that last one's not really considered canon by fans. But in all these versions, haunting, the Phantom himself, the Opera Ghost, represents the lingering effects of the injustice that has been done to Eric, to the Phantom. Because, of course, as I've noted before, he has been driven into this space of having to be the Opera Ghost because of society's discrimination, prejudice and discrimination against him and against people like him, people with quote-unquote deformities. Gaston Leroux talks in the epilogue about how if Eric had had quote-unquote, a normal face, quote-unquote, he could have been among the most successful and respected of people. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but I'll put the actual quote in the blog post. Then in Down Once More, Act 2, Scene 8 of the Lloyd Webber musical, he says, quote, hounded out by everyone, met with hatred everywhere, no kind word from anyone, no compassion anywhere, unquote. Right? So he's literally been reduced to a shadow by the way he's been systematically excluded and discriminated against by all of society. But, of course, in spite of all of this exclusion and discrimination, society hasn't been able to make Eric, make the Phantom, disappear entirely. He's still there. He's still very much alive and present. And as Avery F. Gordon talks about in other contexts, that lingering presence becomes the haunting. It becomes the ghost, in this case the Opera Ghost, that won't let society simply rest easy and forget about it. It calls repeated attention to the fact that something or someone has been attempted to be erased and disappeared, and in fact, it demands redress for that erasure and disappearance. You can read the Phantom's salary that he demands, the 20,000 francs a month, as, in a way, a demand for reparations. And I think in the ALW musical, you can perhaps read his demanding that they perform his opera, Don Juan Triumphant, as a form of demand for reparations, too. But of course, society doesn't want to remember what it's done. It doesn't want to remember who it has violently excluded and marginalized and driven into the shadows. So when people encounter the Phantom, the lingering presence that won't simply disappear quietly and nicely, that presence, the Phantom, and his demands for attention and compensation, reparation, become something frightening, something unsettling, something uncanny. It becomes, as Gordon talks about, a sort of social slash political version, a social and political, as well as personal, version of what Freud called the return of the repressed, where the thing or the person or the event that you've tried to shut away, put out of sight, and that's you personally and or collectively and or socially, that thing or person makes its slash their presence known, but you still don't want to think about it, don't want to acknowledge or remember it, or know about it in the first place, for that matter. So, again, it becomes something scary, something unsettling, something sinister and disturbing. And that's exactly what happens with Eric, with the Phantom. He's literally driven underground and into the shadows by the way society treats him because of his face, and he becomes the opera ghost. He haunts the opera house. And they either take his manifestations as the opera ghost at face value, as it were, and find him scary and disturbing, or, like Raoul, like Christine until she really gets it, or like Madame Giry in the Lloyd Webber version, even when they know the Phantom is human, even when they know he's not a ghost, they either don't understand or don't want to understand why he's become the opera ghost, and so still find him scary and disturbing. Indeed, in some ways they find him even more frightening and disturbing than the people who simply think he's a supernatural entity. Because without that context, without being willing to know and understand that context, he's simply incomprehensible and alien to them. But of course, once Christine at least gets it, once she understands that it's society's treatment of him that's made Eric, made the Phantom the way he is, and that what he needs is compassion, and even some measure of justice, he stops being alien, incomprehensible, and frightening. Which is also a part of haunting, or an aspect of haunting, that Avery F. Gordon talks about extensively in their book. But the brilliant thing about the way haunting works in Phantom specifically is that it's more complicated than just a simple representation of the way society drives certain kinds of people into the shadows. Because, recall, I mentioned back at the beginning of this discussion that the Phantom isn't actually a phantom. He's not a supernatural manifestation of a dead person. He's a living person who's taken on the role, the persona, of a ghost, of a phantom. And while it's certainly true that he's been driven to it by the way society has marginalized him, it's also true that he has embraced and cultivated this role, this persona of the opera ghost, very deliberately. Susan Kay makes that very explicit. LaRue makes that more or less explicit, and the ALW version, stage version, strongly implies it. And so his haunting, his taking on the role of the opera ghost, can be understood also as a deliberate survival strategy. Because through his persona of the Phantom, Eric, the Phantom, is able to retain some interaction with society and to not be completely cut off and isolated, but it puts a buffer between him and society and allows him to interact with society from a space of relative safety from the kind of rejection and discrimination that he faced when trying to interact with society directly. So in that way, haunting in Phantom can be understood as a very proactive survival strategy for someone who is profoundly excluded from and marginalized by normative society. But even more than that, haunting in Phantom can be understood as a strategy not only of survival, but of resistance. Because being the Phantom, being the opera ghost, allows him to do more than just interact with society from a place of relative safety so that he's not completely isolated. It allows Eric, it allows the Phantom to show society even if they don't fully know who he is or what their relationship to him is, that he's still there, that they haven't succeeded in erasing him, that normative society hasn't succeeded in erasing him. And more than that, as I mentioned before, it even allows him to demand some measure of redress, of compensation, of reparation from society, in the form of his salary, the 20,000 francs a month that he demands from the opera management, and, in the ALW version, in the form of demanding that they perform his opera. And the persona of the Phantom allows him to carve out a space of power and dignity for himself, too. And as I talked about way back in episode 3, I think that's especially true in the ALW stage version, where the Phantom's underground home is neither a sad attempt to replicate a respectable bourgeois home using his late mother's furniture, nor a luxurious tomb in which he's prematurely buried himself, as it is in LaRue and Susan Kay. But instead, in the ALW stage version, the Phantom's lair, his underground home, is actually part of his Phantom persona. And it's a very magnificent space full of magic and mystery. And his Phantom persona itself in ALW is not simply a playing up of the skeletal or cadaverous aspects of his appearance in order to frighten people, as it is in LaRue and Susan Kay. Instead, the Phantom of the ALW stage version creates and cultivates a Phantom persona that is very much a figure of mystery and power, and whose costume, the cloak, the fedora, the mask, and whose home, in being called the lair, as I mentioned before, invoke the tradition or the trope of the romantic / romanticized outlaw figure. Think like Zorro or Dick Durbin or something like that. And I would suggest that in creating this persona of romance, of romanticism, of mystery, of power, of magnificence, the Phantom of the ALW stage version is asserting and insisting on his right to participate in beauty and in aesthetic creation against normative societies telling him that because of his quote-unquote deformity, he has no right to those things. And in his lair, where he writes his own music and where he's created this romantic, magnificent space, and in his attempts to direct the artistic direction of the opera house, he's trying to carve out a space for himself in the world of beauty and of aesthetic participation against society's efforts to deny him that. And so, in these ways, his Phantom persona becomes not just a survival strategy, but, I would argue, a very profound and powerful act of resistance. And his haunting, his taking on and embracing that persona, becomes a strategy of resistance. Now, it might be a flawed strategy of resistance, and certainly, in terms of the way the story goes in canon, it's ultimately an unsuccessful strategy of resistance. But being flawed and ultimately unsuccessful doesn't make it invalid or any less powerful. It just means there's lots of room to creatively rework and build on it. So haunting in Phantom, then, becomes this amazing three-way braided extended metaphor for, on one hand, how bodies marked as the other are driven into the shadows, on the other hand, how they can find ways to survive in the shadows, and on the third hand, how those very In the Shadows, survival strategies can in fact become strategies of resistance, especially through artistic slash creative self-expression. And as I said at the beginning, I think the fact that haunting has this richly layered meaning and symbolism, that it is this extended metaphor in Phantom, is part of what makes the story so powerful, especially in its best, most serious versions. The more so because not only is there all this, as I've said, richly layered meaning around the Phantom as the opera ghost doing the haunting, but then there's also the choice of where the haunting takes place, where is being haunted. Because, again, it's a bit non-traditional, non-classical, right? Because typically, we tend to think of haunted buildings or haunted places being like castles or houses or cemeteries, right? Places that in some way represent or symbolize history, either personal or family history or broader social history. But a theater? And yet, having this haunting, which is not a haunting, but is in fact an act of displacement, survival, and resistance, take place in a theater is actually a stroke of genius. Because, as Avery F. Gordon points out, hauntings are, deeply tied in with the issue of storytelling. And not just for the obvious reason that telling ghost stories is an extremely popular form of entertainment, right? Gordon points out that haunting is deeply tied into the issue of whose stories get told and how do those stories get told and whose stories don't get told, right? It's deeply tied in with the issue of whose stories get sort of incorporated into the larger stories that we tell ourselves about who we are as a society or as societies, and whose stories get erased or written out of those larger social stories. And so having the Phantom haunt, perform his act of displacement, survival, and resistance that is his haunting in a theater is brilliant, because of course a theater is one of the key areas, especially before cinema really took off, before film really took off. A theater, an opera house, would be one of the key places where that issue of whose stories get told and how is contested, is played out. Because in France, in Europe in the 19th century, even more so than now, art, opera, music was really tied up with national pride, with national identity, and was very much promoted as being part of national pride and national identity. And so, a bit like the way TV series or movies function today, the stories played out on stages like that of the Paris Opera House would have presented and represented national ideals. The country, say for example of France's ideals of itself, its ideals of its model citizen, and played those ideals back to their audience, and in doing so contributed to the ongoing process of shaping those ideals. And so having the Phantom haunt an opera house allows the story to plug into a debate that was just beginning to rage at the time the Phantom story takes place over whose stories would be part of shaping those ideals up there on stage. Because by the time the Phantom story takes place, set in the 1880s, roughly, access to music and to opera had been fairly well democratized. Works were written and performed for public consumption rather than being sort of privately hired by individual high aristocrats or kings with their own private orchestras, as would have been the case a century earlier in Mozart's time. And music education had been fairly well democratized too, to the point where it was common at least among the middle class, if not the working class and the poor. But even a fairly low-income working person could scrape together enough for an opera or theater or concert ticket on a reasonably regular basis, and many poor students did exactly that. And it wasn't even across Europe either. Some countries were much more democratized in their access to arts and music than others. But even in a country like France, where access to music and the arts was quite democratized, at least in the opera world, that wasn't really reflected in what you saw on stage. What you saw on stage still tended, with some notable exceptions, to be gods, heroes, kings, emperors, princes, princesses, exoticized people from imagined versions of other cultures. Basically, it still tended largely to be the elite and the larger than life. The only place you would sort of have seen portrayals of ordinary people would have been in comic opera, think The Barber of Seville. But of course, these would have been played for laughs. Right around the time that Phantom takes place, though, or maybe shortly thereafter, you start to get pushback on this from artists, from composers. More so in Italy than in France, but still, you get composers like Puccini, for example, he's really kind of the prime example of this, saying, hey, wait a minute, let's start writing serious operas about ordinary people. It was a school of thought called Verismo, which means realism in Italian, and it sparked a lively debate that would go on for many decades among composers, philosophers, critics, academics, etc., about not only who opera and music should be financially and educationally accessible to, but who it should be about, whose stories should be up there on stage. And similar debates were taking place in other art idioms as well, in literature, in painting, in theater. And of course, they would be picked up later in film and television. You can kind of hear reverberations of those debates to this day in calls for greater, more and better representation of people of color, queer and trans people, disabled people in film and television and other media, not only in terms of casting, but also in terms of who's of the kinds of stories that are being told. And so, as I said, having the Phantom haunt an opera house, a theater, allows the story to plug in to these debates, both as they were happening at the time when the story takes place, and I would argue today as well. Because the Phantom, especially the LaRue Phantom or the Susan Kay Phantom, but even the ALW Phantom, as we saw by the downgrading of his deformity in the Jerrick, as I talked about back in episode 4, I think it was, the Phantom is not a person whose story would have been put up on that stage at the Paris Opera House at the time when the story takes place, certainly not in a sympathetic way. And even today, as I talked about back in episode 14, the way that the Phantom is portrayed, not only sympathetically, but desirably, even though he's significantly deformed, disfigured, in the ALW stage musical, is very unusual, even in today's theater and film and television. So having the Phantom haunt a place where cultural narratives are being produced really allows that issue of whose, which stories are being amplified and whose stories are being erased to be brought together with, and I would say to be challenged by, this, as I said before, braided metaphor of haunting as, in one strand, as it were, a marginalized person, body, mind, being driven into the shadows, and the sort of uneasiness, disquiet around that honor. In the second strand, their survival strategy. And on the third, of course, they're turning that into a strategy of resistance through, as I talked about before, art and creative self-expression. And you could make the case, and I think I would make the case, that it points to how, especially in our current system where not everyone has equal access to having their story told and having their story be part of the culture, that all art, that all media is haunted, in Gordon's sense, by the voices that aren't there, by the stories that aren't being told. And you could argue that what the phantom haunts is, in fact, are, in fact, the issues of storytelling and representation themselves. And as I said, to me, this is just beautifully embodied by having this character, the phantom, who is driven into the shadows through marginalization, take up the role of a ghost, take up the persona of a ghost, and haunt a theater where this very issue, these very issues are being played out, especially in the ALW stage musical version, where in fact he ultimately demands that his own work be performed on stage. And of course, it culminates in the final lair when Christine finally has the presence of mind to ask, "What kind of life have you known?" Act 2, Scene 9. She stops trying to fit him, to fit the Phantom, into the dominant narrative of hero and villain, and finally asks what his own story is. Because, as Gordon suggests, that, unearthing and telling the stories that have been silenced and buried, is the first step in exorcising the bad parts of the haunting and turning it from something harmful into something empowering. In Phantom terms, it's the first step in what I talked about back in episode 14, I think it was, of getting back from having been to the space of the final lair to the transformative potential of the title song and music of the night. Getting back to where the full potential of haunting can be explored both as an act of resistance and as an act of transformation, starting from the awesome potential of the title song and music of the night. Because although he obviously really loses his way after the first unmasking and Christine's rejection, Act 1, Scene 6, and even though he, because he loses his way so badly, does a lot of shit that's really wrong, Christine does ultimately have that moment in the final lair, Act 2, Scene 9, of asking what his own story is and then saying, quote, "Give me courage to show you you are not alone," unquote. And so, even though his resistance is seriously flawed by how badly he loses his way, I think I have to take back what I said before about it being unsuccessful. Because in that moment when Christine asks what his real story is and says you're not alone, he, the Phantom, does receive some measure, at least, of real justice. Now, it's not enough, obviously, and he still ends up having to let Christine go, because that's the right thing to do, but it's not a complete failure either, because, as I said, he is able to win some small measure of real justice. So, to me at least, the challenge then is to imagine what the Phantom's haunting might look like, what that Phantom persona might look like as a more successful strategy of resistance that actually builds on the awesome sense of liberation that you find in the title song and music of the night. And I can't say that doesn't lose its way, because that's probably impossible. Life doesn't work that way, especially not after something like the unmasking in Act 1, Scene 6. But at least has more robust healing and recovery techniques and mechanisms in place to minimize harm and to, as quickly as possible, restore that haunting, that phantom persona, to being awesome and powerful and empowering and creative, which is at the heart of what good and successful strategies of resistance are about, and, of course, I would say, is at the heart of what Phantom's about, too. So, I hope you've all enjoyed my discussion and exploration of the haunting aspect of Phantom. I hope it's given you all lots to think about. For next episode, I'm going to switch gears a bit and talk about one of my all-time favorite fanfics. In fact, the fanfic that in many ways inspired my master's thesis. And talk about how it brings Phantom together with the issue of environmental justice. So I'm really excited about that, and I hope you all will enjoy that as much as I will. And in the meantime, of course, you can get in touch with the show in all the usual ways. You can tweet at the show or follow it on Twitter at ITLPodcast. You can, of course, like or follow the Facebook page or join the Facebook group, both of which are the title of the show in this labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Hours. You can leave a comment on the podcast website, which is at https://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm, or you can send an old-fashioned email to inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com. And of course, I would, as always, love to hear from listeners, to hear how this, or any other episode for that matter, is landing for you. Or if you have ideas for topics that you'd like me to cover on the show, by all means send them my way. Or if you would like to be on the show, if you'd like to come on the show and do an interview, that would be awesome. I would love to have other voices on this show besides just mine, because the fan community is way bigger than just me. There are lots of other voices and perspectives out there. So yeah, if you'd like to come on the show, by all means, send me a tweet or a Facebook DM, Facebook private message, or send me an email, and it would be awesome to make that happen. So once again, I hope you all really enjoyed this episode. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I've enjoyed recording it. And of course, I hope you all had a good, safe, and fun Halloween. And didn't gorge yourselves too much on candies, though I fully understand the temptation. And last but not least, of course, I hope you'll all stay tuned and join me for next episode. And have a great, fun, safe, and phantom-filled time in the meantime. Disclaimer. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not reflect the views of the host, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Cameron McIntosh, the Really Useful Group, or any other person or entity. In addition, this podcast is not in any way affiliated with Andrew Lloyd Webber, the Really Useful Group, Cameron McIntosh, or with any other person or entity involved in the production of any version of Phantom.